Hey, I want to welcome all of our partner churches from all over the country who are watching today. And of course, our Atlanta area churches and our friends at Southside. And a quick shout out to those of you at Brownsbridge Church, a little bit north of here. Two Sundays ago, October 5th, you had a baptism Sunday at Brownsbridge Church. They baptized over 250 people on a single Sunday. It was amazing. If you follow me on Instagram, I actually posted a little summary video, and I'm sure it's on their website as well. It was so inspiring. Every time I watch it, I just get teary-eyed, and I'm just so proud of our church and excited about what's happening all over our city and all the other places that we get to be a part of. So jumping into today's content, one of the reasons that you respect the people that you respect most, and this isn't a religious thing, this is just kind of a thing, but all the people that you respect the most, one of the reasons you respect them the most is their response to one or both of two things. You respect them because of their response either to adversity or prosperity, or perhaps both if, you know, if the winds change for them. But the people that we respect most are the people who have responded to adversity and prosperity in unusual ways. People who were hurt and then chose not to hurt back. People who were treated unjustly, but then didn't strike back at the people who treated them unjustly. And what's so amazing, and you know these people, you've met them, in fact, some of you are them, you've met people who just seem to have their life together and everything's great. They're kind of a wrinkle-free, you know, people, and everything's just wonderful. And then you hear their story, and there's so much adversity and heartbreak, either relationally or physically or medically or whatever it might be, and you're shocked. You're just shocked because you feel like, wait a minute, you just don't seem to be the kind of person that's been through that. And the reason that we're so impressed is because of their response to heartache and heartbreak. And then at the same time, you've met people who have a lot because they've worked hard, or they built something or sold something, or they're just very, very successful. And you don't know that when you meet them, and you find that out down the road because they've not been affected by it. In fact, you wouldn't know they had a lot unless you knew. They're generous, but not pretentious. They're comfortable. And again, it's because of the way they have responded to prosperity. So the people that we're most impressed with, generally, they fall into, to some extent, they fall into one of these two categories. And we respect them, again, because of how they exercise what we're calling in this series, the way they've exercised their superpower, their respondability, their ability to respond and choose a response rather than having the response chosen for them, either because of circumstances or because of people around them. And as we talked about last time, this is a superpower, obviously, that all of us share. And it has such extraordinary potential. This superpower that we all have has the potential to thwart evil, to reverse the course of a life. It has the power, as we are seeing in the story we're looking at together, to redeem suffering, and it empowers us to choose our way forward rather than having our way forward chosen for us by other people or by circumstances. It allows us to choose our way forward regardless of what life brings our way and regardless of what life in the past brought our way. And your respondability, your ability to respond, it empowers you, it empowers me, it empowers us to respond rather than react. And we talked a lot about this in part one of the series, that oftentimes a reaction to something, a reaction to makes us a reflection of, a reaction makes us a reflection, a reaction to makes us oftentimes a reflection of the behavior of other people. A reaction to can make us a reflection of circumstances that were forced on us. And a reaction, you know this, as adults we know this, but we forget. A reaction is basically relinquishing control of our lives. And here's the thing, and here's what we're going to talk about a little bit today, so get this part. If we stare too long in the direction of our hurt, or if we stare too long in the direction of our prosperity, we run the risk of absorbing the characteristics of our adversity and our prosperity. This is why people are affected. So let me say that again. If we focus too much, I guess it's another way of saying it. If you focus too long and hard in the direction of your hurt or the direction of your prosperity, over time, you run and we run the risk of absorbing the characteristics of that. That's why you've met people who are so bitter And when you hear their story, you understand why they're so bitter. You understand why they're so angry. But unfortunately, they absorb the characteristics of that. Or you've met people who are so affected by their wealth, affected by their prosperity, and they're uncomfortable. They kind of throw you off balance. And it's because they were affected. And they were affected because they allowed the implications of all that to kind of get on them, I guess is a way of saying this. You don't want to be that way. I don't want to be that way. And people who are that way, they don't want to be that way. They don't even oftentimes know they're that way, right? And this is the power of a measured response. This is the power of your superpower, your respondability. And the people who get this right are the people who amaze us. Instead of reacting to their circumstances, good or bad, they choose what we're calling a measured response. Now, this past Monday in our small group, we discussed the sermons, which is really awkward when you're in the small group with the preacher. And it's amazing. Everybody in our small group always tells me that they thought the sermon was great. You get the opportunity to say, I don't think Andy really knows what he's talking about, but not in our small group. They always just think it's so great. Anyway, so this past Monday, we're talking about last week's message, and Julie in our group made this comment. She said, I really love the phrase, a measured response. She said, I really like the word measured, because she says, to me, measured is calculated. I thought, that's exactly right. A measured response is when you calculate the potential outcomes of a decision. You calculate the potential outcomes of your response, the consequences, long-term and short-term. That a measured response, this is important, a measured response is our opportunity to ask this question. When this season of adversity or when this season of prosperity is over, what do I want the story to be? And what story do I want to tell? Because every season of your life and every season of my life, eventually, it's just a story. It's just a chapter. And when we tell our story, a measured response is a response to where I think this way. When this is over, or if this is ever over, and I'm telling my story, what story do I want to tell about how I responded to these circumstances, whether they be good or not so good? And it's so easy to miss this. It's so easy to miss the opportunity to use our superpower because, again, we said last week, the response that has the potential to reverse the natural order of things, that response is not natural because natural is react. Natural is strike back. Natural is become enamored with. Natural is to become seduced by. But a measured response, it's not intuitive or expected, and it's attention getting. It's why you respect the people you respect the most. Something about their response got your attention. And if you're a Jesus follower or you're considering being a Jesus follower, this is the life. This is the life that Jesus invites us into. It's why so many of his statements, especially in the Sermon on the Mount, when you read it, you think, who does that? Who would respond that way? Who could be that patient? Who could be that forgiving? And Jesus would say, my followers, because you are invited into a life of the catalytic response, the response that has the power to change people and to change things, but it is not natural. So somebody asked Jesus, how many times should we forgive? And he says, until you run out of breath. What should we do to our enemies? Nothing. You are to pray for them. Because when you pray for your enemies, you place yourself in the capable hands of God rather than taking things and taking matters into your own hands. So that's what this series is about. And we're talking about this whole superpower, this respondability, as we look at the life of Old Testament Joseph. This is part two, if you're just joining us, of the response of a lifetime. And we're unpacking this by tracking with Joseph. There's a lot of Josephs in the Bible, as you may know. There's New Testament Joseph, the father, the earthly father of Jesus. But Old Testament Joseph is a famous Joseph and his catalytic responses over the period of a lot of years. That's why we're looking at his story. And that's why we're talking about it for 3 weeks. His catalytic response reminds us and illustrates, and no exaggeration, it reminds us and emphasizes the sustaining, course-reversing, recentering, and no exaggeration, sanity-preserving power of a measured response rather than a reaction. This is why your heavenly Father invites you into this life, and this is why Jesus modeled it for us. So if you weren't here, I'm gonna review real quick. If you grew up in church, you've heard all or parts of this story, so I'll try to make it interesting and try to make this first part quick. So here's how the story begins. Joseph is 17 years old. That's important because we get his ages throughout the story. 17 years old, his father, he has 10 brothers who are jealous of him because Joseph is the favorite son of his father's favorite wife. We talked about the problem with favorite wives last time, so we won't rehearse that. Anyways, the favorite son of the favorite wife, his father sends him to check on his 10 brothers. He goes to check on his brothers. They are sick and tired of him because he's so privileged and his father loves him so much. And then his father gave him this expensive coat. So they decide they're just gonna kill him. So they take Joseph, strip off his clothes, throw him in a cistern, basically an open pit or well, deciding how do we, you know, end his life. Then they decide, hey, let's make a few dollars. They decide instead to sell him as a slave to Ishmaelite slave traders on their way to Egypt. So he gets sold to them, then he gets to Egypt and gets sold again, and he's purchased by a man named Potiphar, who was the captain of the guard of no other than Pharaoh himself. And throughout the story, the author of the story, who knows how the whole story ends, even though Joseph didn't know how it was going to end, the author of the story reminds us of something that is so important for all of us. He says throughout the story that Joseph responded, and that's why we're using this word, that Joseph responded as if God was with him when it looked as if God had in fact abandoned him. And that's the challenge for me. And that's the challenge for you. So now he's a slave. And so what did he do? He outslaved all the other slaves. And eventually, not, you know, he got bought on Monday and by Thursday, eventually, like over the course of several years, he eventually got the attention of his master, Potiphar. And Potiphar recognized his talent. He recognized his hard work. He recognized there was something about this young man, and he elevated him. And eventually, Joseph became the attendant, the personal attendant of Potiphar, and was put in charge of Potiphar's entire household. He served as a slave for years. Now he's in his 20s. Years have gone by. Nobody's looking for him at home. Nobody's looking out for him anywhere. And that's where we're going to pick up the story where we left off last time. The text says this. Now, Joseph, he's been in Potiphar's household for several years now. Joseph was well-built and handsome. And after a while, Potiphar's wife took notice of Joseph and said, come to bed with me. And he refused. Now, I think she'd never been refused is my hunch, okay? Joseph is property. This isn't a request. This is a command. So Joseph tries to reason with her. Now they've had some kind of relationship because he's been in Potiphar's household for several years. So he tries to reason with her. And he says, wait, you don't want to do this. With me in charge, he says, my master, Potiphar, doesn't concern himself with anything in the house. My master has not withheld anything from me except for you. Because, by the way, you are his wife. Have we forgotten what's happening here, right? And then he makes this comment. This is one of those moments in the story that I want you to have in your life, and I want to have in my life, these moments where we do the unexpected, where we say the unexpected, where we refuse to allow circumstances to dictate our actions and to dictate our response. And in this moment, Joseph employs his superpower, his respondability, fused with his faith in God. And he says the unthinkable, and this is so offensive. And this is the first of many offensive statements he makes, although he's not trying to be offensive. He says to Potiphar's wife, how, in light of the fact that your husband has entrusted me with the whole household, how could I do such a wicked thing? And now he's accusing her of being wicked. Why? I mean, how could I, in light of the, he's trusting me, how could I do such a wicked thing? And then this part, and sin against God. And the word he uses for God is his God, Elohim. At which point in the story, I want to stand back and say, whoa, let me just interrupt for a second, ask you a question, Joseph. You don't want to sin against God? Is this the same God that has done nothing for you lately? The same God who stood back and watched as your brothers grabbed you, stripped you of your clothes, threw you in a well, and left you to die, that God, the God who watched as you were sold into slavery, and only God knows, God only knows what happened to you between the time you were taken by the Ishmaelites and the time you showed up in Egypt, the God who did nothing for you, the God who stood by and watched as you were stripped and stood on an auction block and auctioned off to the highest bidder, that's the God you're trying to remain faithful to? The God who now has put you in a no-win situation with your master's wife? And here he is attempting to remain faithful to God. There's been no evidence of God's faithfulness to him, no practical evidence. And again, we're reminded, because we know how the story ends, we're reminded in our lives that just because we can't sense God's presence doesn't mean God isn't present. Just because we don't hear God doesn't mean that God isn't active, that God can be silent and God can be seemingly still and still present in the world and in our lives. And somehow Joseph responds as if God is very much a part of his story and very much aware of what's going on. So that's the God that you're trying not to offend. Again, ever feel this way? I think we all have, right? Maybe you've been a Christian since you were a child like me. Maybe you've been a Christian since you're a child and you've tried to do everything right and things continue to go wrong for you, but things continue to go right for people who aren't near as faithful. I mean, you wouldn't say this, so I'll say it on your behalf. You really are a better person than her. You really are a better person than him. You really have been more faithful to God than them, and yet they seem to get all the breaks and nothing comes your way. And you think to yourself at times, why am I even bothering? Why am I bothering to pray? Why am I bothering to believe? This is the situation Joseph's in. And even under these harsh circumstances, this is a life or death decision for him. He decides to remain faithful to the God who seemingly has not been faithful to him in return. Maybe it's this dynamic that caused you to leave faith. Or maybe this is the dynamic that caused you to leave faith in the sense that you watch somebody who is a God person, you would say, or a Christian or some kind of faithful person. You watch them go through difficulty after difficulty after difficulty in spite of the fact that they were faithful. And you said to yourself, you know what? I'm out. If that's how it works, if that's all we can trust God to do, I'm out. It was just too much for you. And here's what I would just say before we get back to the story. As you consider or reconsider Christianity, here's something to keep in mind. Experiences like maybe the ones you've had or experiences like the ones that the people you love have had, those do not stand in contrast to the story of the Christian faith. Those experiences are baked into the story of the Christian faith from the very beginning. Because as I say all the time, in Christianity, God allowed the worst possible thing to happen to the best possible person, Jesus, his son. So in spite of the fact that we don't like it, and as we're going to see in a minute, like Joseph, we certainly don't enjoy it. It is not evidence for the lack of God or a lack of God's love or a lack of God's care. It is evidence of the fact that God is actually, as we're going to see, with you. And when we use our superpower, when we respond as if God is with us, we are setting the stage for God to do something extraordinary through us. And those are the people that blow our minds. Back to the story. Potiphar's wife is relentless. The text says that day after day after day, she's like, come to bed with me, come to bed with me. Then one afternoon, she sends everybody out of the house. It's just her and Joseph. And she walks up to him and she grabs his cloak and she tries to pull him over to her, and he twists himself out of the cloak and flees and leaves the house. And there she is holding his cloak. Evidence, she's gonna say, of evidence of the fact that he tried to do the very thing he attempted to do the very thing that he had already committed not to do. And she takes the evidence to Potiphar, her husband, and says, that Hebrew that you brought into our home, he tried to attack me, and shows Potiphar Joseph's cloak. And so now Potiphar has to respond. Now here's just my hunch. I don't think he believed her. I don't think he believed her because I think he would have executed Joseph if he had believed her. Maybe this had happened before, who knows? Maybe he's so enamored with and so impressed by Joseph, he can't bear the thought of executing this Hebrew boy that has been so faithful to his family. We don't know, but he has to do something. So he throws Joseph in the dungeon, in the prison, and it's the same prison that Pharaoh puts his prisoners in as well. So once he gets to prison, Joseph has to then update his resume, his impressive resume. So here it is. Joseph Jacobson, kidnapped once, sold twice, falsely accused, and imprisoned. Bad things have been happening to good people since the very beginning. And bad things happening to good people is not evidence for the lack of God. It's not evidence for the lack of the love of God. It is in the story of Christianity from the very beginning. But once again, the author reminds us that while Joseph was there in Pharaoh's prison, later they're going to use the word dungeon, they're interchangeable. But while Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him. Now, again, here's my kind of cynical thought. So don't write this down or take this too seriously. I think at some point, if it was you or me, and maybe Joseph had these thoughts, we don't know. At some point, Joseph has to be thinking, hey, Lord, I got an idea. How about you go be with someone else for a while? Okay, you're killing me. If you look, ever since you've been with me, things have gone from bad to worse. I have an idea. I would like for you to go be with my brothers. Take your time, stay as long as you want and give me a break, right? Because I know you're with me, but it's not helping me. It's helped Potiphar. It's helped the people who've made money off of me. But for some reason, you being with me isn't helping me. It's killing me. He was thrown into a dungeon, and again, years go by. Every day is the same. He doesn't know how his story ends. Nobody's looking for him. Nobody's looking out for him. At home, they all think he's dead. Years go by. The food is the same. The labor is the same. And again, all of this is wrong because if the Lord was with Joseph, he would not be in the prison, would he? But again, even there, he uses his superpower. He refuses to react. He refuses to stare too long at the tragedy and begin to absorb and reflect the tragedy and the circumstances. He refuses to stare too long at the people who have hurt him, so he does not, in fact, absorb the characteristics of the people who've hurt him. And he uses his superpower, and he responds as if God was with him. So the text says that once he got there, after time went by, the Lord is with him and showed Joseph kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. But again, I say, okay, that's great. But if you have a personal relationship with a prison warden, things are not going well for you, regardless if God is with you or not, right? Years go by. Years, again, every day is the same. There's no weekends. The food is terrible. And then, seemingly, something completely unrelated takes place. But nothing is really ultimately unrelated or random. Far away, he doesn't know about this, Pharaoh's baker and Pharaoh's cupbearer, his wine taster, the person, his food taster to make sure Pharaoh isn't being poisoned. These two gentlemen have an incident with Pharaoh, and we don't know what it is, but Pharaoh is very, very angry with them, and he throws both of these gentlemen in his dungeon, in his prison, where they meet Joseph. Time goes by. Joseph begins to serve these two men who had served Pharaoh. Time goes by. Years go by. And then one morning, he notices they're kind of whispering to each other in the corner, and something's up and something's wrong, and there's no new information. Nobody comes or goes. So he has no idea why. And he eventually says, hey, what's wrong? I can see something's bothering you. They're like, well, we're in the dungeon. Let's start there. But beyond being in the dungeon, there's something else. So they look at each other, and then one of them speaks up and says, well, since you asked, we both had dreams last night, but there's no one here to interpret the dreams. Now, a comment about dreams. Okay, dream interpretation was a pay-to-play business in ancient times. You had to go to the temple, you had to pay a fee to find a dream interpreter. And they believed that the gods spoke through dreams. And if you awoke in the morning and you could remember the details of your dreams, it's because the gods had spoken to you and the gods are giving you a heads up about something you should do or shouldn't do. It's a blessing, it's a curse, it's a warning. And both of them having significant dreams on the same night, they knew something was up. They desperately needed an interpreter, but they're in prison. And so Joseph says to them, hey, give me a shot. Let me take a shot. Just tell me your dream. So the cupbearer says, all right, what do we have to lose? And he tells Joseph this strange dream. He said, well, I dreamed there was this giant vine. It grew quickly, and there were these big grapes, and I was mashing the grapes, and the juice from the grapes were going into the cup of Pharaoh. And Joseph smiles and says, that's an easy one. I got good news for you. And this is the amazing thing. He puts a date on a prediction. You know, you don't do that, but he does. He puts a date on a prediction. He says, within 3 days, Pharaoh is going to lift up your head and restore you to your position. And then what Joseph says next, this is so important. What Joseph says next reminds us, actually, I don't think reminds, assures us that he's very human. That he's not enjoying this. When you read the story, it sounds like he's just kind of skimming along the surface of all these terrible circumstances. He's miserable. He's on the edge of becoming bitter and losing sight of the fact that maybe there's an end to this. Maybe there's a purpose to this. Because again, his life has become meaningless and purposeless. And so he says to the cupbearer, hey, the good news is you're going to be restored. But when all goes well for you, remember me. Don't forget me. Everyone has forgotten me. Remember me and show me kindness. Mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison. And then he just breaks and gushes and tells them his story. I was kidnapped. And even here, I've done nothing to deserve being put in a dungeon. And of course, the cupbearer is thinking, dude, hey, if 3 days from now I'm restored, I remember you, I'll never forget you, and I'm gonna sing your praises everywhere I go. That would be remarkable. I'm a bit skeptical, but that would be remarkable. Then the baker's like, what about me? What about my dream? So he tells his dream. His dream, he said, I dreamed that I had a giant basket on my head, and it had bread in it. Of course, he's the baker. It was full of loaves of bread, and the birds came down and ate the bread out of the basket on my head. And Joseph looks at him and says, gee, that's a tough one. I'm afraid I can't help you. Maybe that's what he should have said. Instead, he said, here's your interpretation. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head. And then he should have just stopped there. That would have been good. And impale your body on a pole. He could have just stopped there. But you know that whole dream part with the birds? Let me tell you what that means. And the birds are going to eat away your flesh. 3 days later, it happens exactly like Joseph predicted. The cupbearer is restored. And what do you think Joseph does? He does what I would do. He does what you would do. He would, when he heard, got news that, because somebody comes and gets both of these guys, leads them out of the prison. And the cupbearer's thinking, oh, good. And the baker's like, I'd like to stick. Could I stay? The cupbearer's restored, the baker's executed. And so what does Joseph think? He thinks, finally, the Lord is really with me. This is how it's supposed to work. I've got somebody in Pharaoh's palace who knows my name and knows that what I have just done. So 2 days later, he hears somebody coming in on the upper floor and he thinks, this is my day, and nothing. And days later, there's other visitors and he thinks, well, this is it. He's finally told Pharaoh about me and nothing. Because the text tells us that the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. Once again, maybe this is where your story intersects the story of Joseph, because you feel like God has forgotten you. He hasn't forgotten everybody else around you, but he's not answering your prayers. He's not showing up for you. And it takes everything in you to remain faithful to the God who doesn't seem faithful to you. And the challenge of the story and the challenge of the gospel and the challenge of the message of Jesus is, will you trust me? And will you respond as if I'm with you rather than allowing circumstances and people to dictate the decisions you make in your life? Not because you don't have every justification in the world to react, but because you've pre-decided, I'm gonna respond as if God is with me. Because to respond as if God is with me is to set the table for God to do the unusual if God chooses to do so. 2 more years go by. He has given up all hope. And now he is 30 years old. This adventure started when he was 17. And then another random event. Pharaoh has a disturbing dream. And nobody can interpret Pharaoh's dreams. And the whole palace understands that he's brooding, he's upset. He knows that these dreams have meaning. And he can't even pay anybody to come up with an interpretation. Nobody's even taken a shot at it. And this, the ripple effects of this are significant within the palace and eventually could be significant within the country as he tries to decide what these dreams meant because he knew them and remembered them in detail. And finally, the cupbearer comes to his senses and he remembers Joseph, but he has a dilemma. If I tell the Pharaoh about Joseph, that means I have to remind the Pharaoh that we had a falling out and he threw me in his dungeon. I'm not sure it's worth bringing that back up. But time goes by. And finally, he decides. He goes to Pharaoh and basically says, okay, remember that little thing? It was such a little thing. I don't remember any, you probably don't remember it all. It was such a tiny thing. But anyway, I spent some time, short amount of time, in your dungeon. The details aren't important. But while I was there, I met a young Hebrew boy. And he predicted that I would be restored. And what he predicted actually happened based on a dream I told him. And then Pharaoh interrupts and says, get him. So they cut his hair and clean him up and put on some nice clothes and they bring him into the palace to meet Pharaoh. The text says, so Pharaoh immediately sent for Joseph and he was quickly brought from the dungeon. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I had a dream and no one can interpret it, but I have heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. And I imagine the cupbearer standing there like, please get this right. Please, you don't even know what's hanging in the balance. You gotta get this right. And what, don't miss this part. And what Joseph says next might be the most courageous words ever spoken by anyone under any circumstances. He's a foreigner. He's a slave. He's a criminal. And this is his big break. We would see it as this is your big break. You know, initially anybody from the outside would see this, oh, this is your big break. But it wasn't just a big break. This was a big test. Will he still respond as if God is with him? And he does. Listen to what he says. He looks at the most powerful man in the world, the man with a word could release him and send him home. And Joseph says to Pharaoh, I cannot do it. And the cupbearer is like, oh no. But Joseph had come this far trusting in his God. So he goes the whole way and says something that we can't even begin to imagine how offensive this was to Pharaoh. He says, I cannot do it, but Elohim, my God, Abraham's God, Isaac's God, my father Jacob's God, our God, a foreign God, not an Egyptian God, will give Pharaoh the answer he desires. And a hush falls over the room. Fortunately for Joseph, Pharaoh was more curious than offended. And he says, tell me. And Joseph begins. And he says, here's what your dreams mean, O Pharaoh. For the next 7 years, there's going to be an abundant harvest of grain. And following those 7 years, there's going to be 7 years of famine. And what's important to understand is that in ancient times, ancient civilizations, they survived or died based on grain supply. Because grain was obviously how you make bread, and grain was the only thing that you could keep for a long time, and grain was pretty much the only food that you could transport a long way. So grain, it was live or die. He said over the first 7 years, there's gonna be so much grain that it's gonna be followed by years of famine. And he says, the famine is gonna be so bad, Pharaoh, that everyone's gonna forget the 7 good years. And then he punctuates it with this, and he says, this is so offensive. This matter, what I've just told you, has been firmly decided by my God, and my God Elohim will do it soon. Implication, my God controls the economy of your world, Pharaoh. And then even more offensive, the foreigner, the slave, the criminal doesn't stop talking. He goes on to give Pharaoh advice. No one gives Pharaoh advice unless Pharaoh asks for it. And he says, and now let Pharaoh, somebody take notes. And now let Pharaoh look for a discerning and wise man and put him in charge of the land of Egypt. And let Pharaoh appoint commissioners over the land and take a fifth of all the harvest of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. And they should collect all of that grain, all of that food in the good years that are coming and store up the grain under the authority of Pharaoh. He liked that part. All this extra grain, 20% tithe of grain, Pharaoh, you're gonna own that grain to be kept in the cities for food. And he says, this food, this extra grain should be held in reserve. Don't start using it as soon as the famine begins. It's to be used during the 7 years of famine so that the country may not be ruined by the famine. And then he stops. And you can hear a pin drop, and everybody expected a head drop. Nobody speaks to Pharaoh this way. But the Lord was with Joseph in the cistern, in the prison, and in the palace. Long pause, I think. Pharaoh looks around. Again, now he offends all of his attendants. He says, since Elohim, this other God, has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. So you shall be in charge. And there's a gasp in the courtroom, in the palace room, because wait, you're gonna put a foreigner in charge? Essentially what this meant is this: I'm gonna put you in charge because we need somebody to wake up thinking about this every single day until these 14 years come and go. And so you're gonna be in charge of waking up. You have one responsibility. You'll be in charge, and only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you and all of Egypt. And then Joseph did what Joseph had always done. He went to work. He went to work and did his very best and used all of those gifts and skills that he had been given to save the nation of Egypt. During the first 7 years, he oversaw construction of massive grain silos in all the major cities in Egypt. In fact, the text says that Joseph, under this incredible plan he came up with, Joseph stored up huge quantities of grain, like the sand of the sea. It was so much that he stopped keeping records because it was beyond measure. And then in year 8, the Nile didn't overflow its banks. Depositing, when the Nile would overflow its banks, that's what would make the soil so rich. It didn't deposit the nutrient-rich sediment that was vital for agriculture. And then the next year, the same thing happened. And the next year, the same thing happened. And for 7 years, the Nile doesn't overflow its banks. And about halfway into year 2, there was a famine in the land. And when things got so bad and everybody had used up their extra storehouse of grain, he opened the storehouses and sold the grain. And he sold all that extra grain in the name of Pharaoh. If you read this story just on its own, it's amazing. Essentially, by the end of the 14 years, Pharaoh personally owned every single person and every single animal and all the land in Egypt. Personally, because of the system that Joseph had created. And now he is 40 years old. But of course, the famine spread beyond the borders of Egypt, right? And soon in the surrounding regions, there was a rumor that you can find grain in Egypt. You can't find grain anywhere else, but somehow there is grain in Egypt. And up north, Joseph's family is beginning to starve. And they sit there, and the text is kind of funny. It says, when Jacob, that's Joseph's father, who thinks Joseph is dead, when Jacob, Joseph's father, learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, it's kind of funny. He said, why do you keep looking at each other? In other words, get up and do something. He says, I have heard, and you've heard, we've all heard, there is grain in Egypt. So go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die. And the music changes. And suddenly the stage is set. I don't want you to miss this. Don't miss next week. The stage is set for the ultimate test of Joseph's superpower. Because now he's prime minister of a superpower. And now he's got the power. Don't miss this. And now that he has the power, now that he's been elevated, he doesn't really need the Lord to be with him any longer. Does he? Do you? Do I? This is the supreme test. This is the test that very few people pass. This is why Jesus said one of the most unusual things he said that everybody's trying to figure out what he meant. Because he turned to his disciples one day and said, guys, listen, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God, because rich men don't think they need God. So what do you do? This is the question I'm gonna leave you with. What do you do when it dawns on you that you're holding all the cards? What do you do when it dawns on you that you've got everything you need and everything you want? What do you do when it dawns on you and you've got the power? When you make the call, when your words weigh 100 pounds, how should those of us in positions of power or influence respond? If we're confident that God is with us, and we will find out next time when we conclude part 3, the response of a lifetime. Don't miss it. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, thank you for preserving this story. Thank you for Joseph's faithfulness. This lands on all of us in some way, shape, or form, because we all have stuff going on. And we wanna strike back and hit back and get back. We wanna make our case, prove we're right. We don't really wanna trust you like we used to, because we don't feel the pressure that we used to, because things are going pretty well. We're all in this story. And would you do whatever you need to do in each of our hearts, each of our lives, to bring us to the point where we give you our undivided attention and say, I want to respond as if you were with me, because I need you every hour. I need you every minute. I need you more now than ever, or I feel like I need you less now than ever, which means I need you more now than ever, lest I lose sight of God who has called me to follow him. So wherever this lands with us, would you give us the wisdom to respond in a way that brings honor to you and amazes the people around us, not for our sake, but for their sake. And I pray all of that in Jesus' amazing name. Amen.